Northern Israel on Christmas Eve. He appeared in more than 40 films, directed documentaries highlighting the experience of Palestinians under occupation, best known for his 2002 documentary Jenin, Jenin, featuring the voices of Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp following the devastating Israeli military attack that killed 52 Palestinians. In 2007, Mohamed Bakri spoke to Democracy Now! About interviewing survivors of the Jenin massacre.
They wanted to tell their stories because they were still in shock. When I came in Jenin, I was shocked with what I saw. I couldn't think, I couldn't feel. I was really just humiliated as a human being, not as a Palestinian, not as a director, not as an actor, just as a human. How come people can do such things like that in the camp?
Gideon Levy, if you can talk about the significance of Mohamed Bakri. You wrote about him. You were there for the ceremony with his sons, who are also actors like him. Describe what it was like.
First of all, on a personal level, I can't tell you how much I loved him. We spent so much time together, including, by the way, in your New York, because he used to come almost every year to the Israeli Film Festival in the JCC in Manhattan. And we used to meet there from time to time. And in any place he went, and whatever he did, he was, on one hand, a cultural icon, a brave Palestinian patriot. On the other hand, another typical victim of the Zionist or Jewish or Israeli machinery, which totally crashed his life and his career. His film, Jenin Jenin, which was a heartbreaking film about a heartbreaking reality in this refugee camp of Jenin, maybe the most courageous refugee camp in the West Bank, and the most devoted one, his film was an authentic expression of the pain of those people. I used to be there so many times in this refugee camp. I can tell you that what he showed was the real pain of those people. But Israel is not ready to listen to any other pain except of the Israeli pain, obviously. And we are talking about 20 years ago, which means it's not yet Netanyahu, it's not yet this fascist government, it's the legal system of Israel, which has a lot of reputation, the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be a lighthouse of liberalism, and they crashed him until they brought a situation in which his film was forbidden to be screened in Israel. Can you believe, Amy? A film about the suffer of a refugee camp based on facts was censored in Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. And this crashed him because he never recovered of it. He lost almost any chances to work in Israel as an artist, as a director. He kept on working until his last years and last months. His last film I saw was a 5 minutes film, excellent and touching. But Israel crashed him because there is no room for Palestinian patriots in Israel. And there is no room for people in his size in Israel if they are Palestinians or Israeli Arabs, as we like to call them.
Gideon, I just wanted to ask you also, all the attention is on Gaza and the ceasefire, but meanwhile, very little attention on the West Bank. The Israeli cabinet approved the establishment of 19 settler outposts, additional settler outposts on December 11th, and this has been condemned by most European countries, including Canada and Japan, but these settlements and the additional violence and attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank continue. Your response?
So if there was a moment of light in yesterday's press conference with the president and the prime minister, it was when the president was asked about the West Bank, and I felt, maybe I'm wrong, but I felt a little different tone when it came to it. It seemed that here, at least, the United States does not see eye to eye with the darling of Donald Trump, namely Netanyahu. The West Bank, where I travel at least once a week for almost 40 years now, the West Bank is unrecognizable. Whoever, and I guess both of you have been to the West Bank in the past, until 2 years ago, the war in Gaza, it was one West Bank, and in the last 2 years with this government, it's another West Bank. The settlers see the war in Gaza as a huge historical opportunity, as a chance really to implement all their crazy messianic dreams and fantasies, and they are doing it on a daily basis. The army is collaborating with them on a daily basis. The problem is not the recognition of another 19th settlement. The problem is the violence of the settlers, their behavior, and the cooperation with the army. The soldiers are behaving like in Gaza, at least part of them. It is impossible to live in the West Bank after they made Gaza an unlivable place. They are really on the way to turn the West Bank in Iran into an unlivable place. 900 checkpoints. Can you live in a piece of land with 900 checkpoints that you never know which one will be open or which one will be closed? Can you have any normality in this reality? And then when one day it will explode, Israel will be so surprised and so offended. How can it be that the Palestinians are raising their violence again? But what else is left for them?
Gideon Levy, we want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, member of the editorial board. His latest book, The Killing of Gaza, reports on a catastrophe. And thank you to Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist and distinguished public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. We just have 30 seconds, Rami, but I also wanted to get your comment on the passing of Mohamed Bakri.
You know, Mohamed Bakri represents Palestinian culture, creativity, life, and persistence. The Israelis and the Zionist movement before them worked overtime and continued to work overtime to crush any activism that is not only political activism, but literature, poetry, cinema, art, cooking, any creative work that Palestinians do that reflects their humanity and their attachment to their ancient land. The Israelis and the Zionist movement want to crush this. The Americans and the British and a few others seem to go along with this by banning activism for Palestine in many Western lands. And this is the old tradition. You know, the Israelis killed Hassan Kanafani many years ago and a whole bunch of other prominent Palestinian creative artists, and they'll continue to do this, and you get the American system, not the government, but the commercial system, refusing to distribute, say, really good Palestinian films that show the reality in Palestine and Israel. So there's many ways in which his death is a continuation of a longer tradition of Western colonial attempts to essentially erase Palestine, like the British gave Palestine to the Zionist movement in 1917, the Trump today is essentially giving Palestine, Gaza and the West Bank and other places, and South Lebanon and parts of Syria, is giving them to the Israelis. And this is a continuation of a colonial tradition, which is troubling, but it's going on and we have to deal with it.
We want to thank you for being with us. And on Monday, we're going to speak with the Palestinian director, Shireen Dabi, about her new film, All That's Left of You, a powerful multi-generational Palestinian epic. Mohamed Bakri stars in it, as well as his sons, Salah and Adam. That's Monday on Democracy Now! Next up, starting in January, Trump plans to resume garnishing the wages of student loan borrowers in default. Stay with us. Well, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As millions across the United States struggle with rising food and living costs, we look now at how the Trump administration's plans to resume garnishing the wages of student loan borrowers who haven't been able to make their payments for at least 9 months. An estimated 5 million people are currently in default on their student loans. The billionaire Education Department Secretary, Linda McMahon, has confirmed the agency will notify about 1,000 student loan borrowers of plans to withhold a portion of their paychecks starting the week of January 7th. The number of notices will then increase every month for the rest of next year. The Trump administration already began withholding tax refunds and Social Security benefits from some student loan borrowers in default, as it also slashed affordable repayment options for millions of people. We are joined right now by Julia Barnard, the higher education team lead at the Debt Collective, former student loan ombudsman at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, joining us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you so much for being with us, Julia. Can you just start off by explaining what's going to happen for student loan borrowers in default? How many are there? Their wages are going to be garnished?
Yes, thank you for having me. Like you said, we've got around 5 million borrowers currently with federal student loans in default. That number is expected to increase to 10, potentially even as high as 15 million borrowers with loans in that status. Borrowers then become subject to a range of negative consequences, including forced collections like wage garnishment, tax refund offsets, like you mentioned, including seizure of anti-poverty benefits like the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Child Tax Credit, and other refunds, and also negative credit score impacts. So, yes, it's an extremely negative experience for borrowers who have loans in default.
And Julia, in terms of the growth of student debt, it's more than tripled between 2007 and 24, now to more about $1.7 trillion. How did the amount continue to escalate even during the period of this 5-year reprieve that existed?
Yeah. It's a complicated question. Student loans have increased. 44 million Americans now owe student debt to the federal government. That doesn't even include students who put tuition on debt products like credit cards or tuition payment plans or other types of debts. Tuition prices, the cost of college has continued to rise, as we all know, and as you've mentioned in the program. Costs for medical care, healthcare premiums, housing, childcare are going up. So increasingly, individuals are debt financing education, whereas in the past, that used to be a good provided by the government, with the recognition that an educated population makes our nation more competitive and bolsters our democracy.
And what's the latest on the Trump administration's plans to privatize some of this nearly $2 trillion in federal student loan debt?
Yeah, I've read those news reports as well. As far as I can tell, that is not going very far. From what I understand, there's not a lot public about the process. From what I understand and from what I know in my experience, the student loan portfolio is not a very profitable asset. The government is protected from certain consequences, certain legal consequences that private creditors are not protected from. So I think it would be a very risky asset for any private entity looking to buy the entire portfolio or a portion of the portfolio. As I understand it, the only profitable parts of the portfolio are kind of parent plus loans. There are certain tranches of the portfolio that could make sense, but the Debt Collective, for example, has said publicly that we'd like to put in a bid on the non-performing parts of the portfolio, for example, like the parts of the portfolio that are in default status.
Julia, two quick questions. What's the role of the billionaire Education Secretary Linda McMahon? One of your colleagues, Esther Taylor at Debt Collective, has called the Education Department simply a debt collection agency now. And what options do people have?
Yeah, thank you for the question. There's a certain amount of discretion involved. It's a choice to turn on the debt collection program. It's a choice to contact employers and have them garnish wages and send them to the Department of Education. We know from our experience trying to turn off the wage garnishment system during the pandemic that two-thirds of people who were experiencing wage garnishment in 2020 had illegal collections after Congress had voted to stop collections on wages. So it's a very difficult system to turn on and off. And I think it's cruel and hostile to working people to turn the system on before we're sure that we can run it in a compliant manner. Yeah, so I think it's really important for borrowers to know that they're not alone. Like we've talked about, there are millions and millions of borrowers who have loans in default status. We know from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, from state attorneys general, from borrowers themselves, that there's widespread there are widespread errors that can cause people's loans to go into default that have nothing to do with their willingness to repay. A lot of borrowers who go into default kind of intuitively simply do not have the money to pay their student loans. And so the government kind of trying to extract water from a stone, I think, is unnecessary. It's unlikely to result in benefits to the government, to the taxpayer, and certainly to the borrower themselves.
And finally, go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to talk about borrowers' options, if that's all right.
Yes.
So I think it's really important to say that when a loan goes into default, the servicing arrangement is transferred and the loan goes into the hands of a debt collector who may not feel the same responsibility for teaching borrowers about their options. So the Department of Education typically leans on options that require repayment, such as rehabilitation and consolidation for borrowers to get their loans out of default status. However, there are other options such as cancellation, for total and permanent disability discharge. There's false certification discharge. There is, if a school misled a student or committed fraud, there are other types of discharge called borrower defense discharge. There are a lot of ways for borrowers to have their loans canceled that do not require repayment, that the government doesn't necessarily tell borrowers about. So we encourage borrowers to try to understand their options, come to a debt collective event to learn more. You can look at this on the internet, but it's important to know that you can get your loan out of default status without necessarily having to repay. And one final option I want everyone to be aware of is that if you're facing a financial hardship, so 95% of debtors who have their wages garnished say it causes a major or general financial hardship. If that's true, people can immediately contest when they get a notice of wage seizure to say it causes a financial hardship and have that paused. So it's really important to open that mail and get in touch to object to the wage garnishment as soon as you get the notice.
Julia Barnard, I want to thank you for being with us. Currently the higher education team lead at the Debt Collective, former student loan ombudsman at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Next up, starting January 1st, healthcare costs are expected to double or triple for millions of people across the United States. We'll speak with Elizabeth Benjamin, member of the New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's transition team, vice president at Community Service Society. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On January 1st, tens of millions in the United States will see their health insurance costs soar when subsidies under the Affordable Care Act expire. Health insurance premiums are expected to more than double or triple for some 20 million people, pricing many out of health care coverage entirely. The enhanced subsidies were first put in place during the pandemic. Congress is on recess until January 6th, with Republicans reportedly leaving early for a two-week holiday break without voting to extend the ACA or Obamacare tax benefits. Divisions over the issue were at the heart of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history earlier this year, with Democrats insisting on continuing the subsidies. For more, we're joined here in our New York studio by Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President of Health Initiatives at Community Service Society of New York, member of the New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's transition team. Elizabeth, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what's about to happen. It's January 1st.
Yes, starting January 1st, people will no longer have access to what's called enhanced premium tax credits. This enabled us to cover about basically double the number of people that were able to participate in Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act tax premium credit program or financial assistance program that enabled people to purchase health care in a more affordable fashion. You know, the Affordable Care Act benefits really crucial members of society, people, small business owners, self-employed people, gig workers, people, artists, writers, a whole swath of folks will no longer have access just because the premiums are so expensive now and our nation has essentially done nothing to control health care costs. So it's going to be very difficult come January 1st for many, many Americans, about 11 million. On top of that, with H.R. 1, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, we know that that President Trump and the Republicans that voted for this bill will make it much harder for our lowest income members of America to be able to have retain their Medicaid coverage. So between the two, we estimate over 20 million Americans will lose coverage, essentially undoing every single gain we have made over the last 15 years.
And Elizabeth, what are the chances that the subsidies that are set to expire, that Congress can extend them when it comes back into session in January?
Well, they certainly can do it. I have no faith that they will do it. It seems that there is very strong opposition to doing the right thing and making health care more affordable for people in the United States.
And if people begin to turn to alternatives, what scams should they be watching for? Things like short-term plans?
I'm so glad.
Can you explain what they are and how they might work?
I'm so glad you asked this one. It's so important. There are many, many kind of faux insurance products out there. There's short-term plans, but more importantly, there's also a thing called healthcare sharing ministries, which many people are critical of because they say they pose as insurance products when they're really not. They sort of promise a network of doctors and that you can access that networks, but often they don't cover drugs. Those doctors may or may not really participate in them. So I really urge people to go to a navigator or someone in a hospital or a federally qualified healthcare center or a healthcare center and really talk to someone that can help you sort through your insurance, real insurance options.
You've been recognized as one of the leading navigators in the United States, and you really lead a team of navigators, a community service society. Most people have never even heard that term. What do you mean, call a navigator?
Thank you so much, Amy, for asking that question. Navigators are people that have been certified by their local states or the federal government to help people sort through their Affordable Care Act or Obamacare options. They can help people in New York State. They can help people enroll in Medicaid as well as Affordable Care Act coverage. In many states, they're basically health insurance enrollment assisters. And whether it's a certified navigator or someone at a hospital who's a certified application counselor, please go see an expert. There are lots of options to sort through. They will really help you.
If people want to reach Community Service Society, what's the website?
It's cssny.org. But we only help people in New York. So I really, you can go on the World Wide Web and search up a local navigator or certified application counselor near you, or just go to your healthcare provider. As long as they're sort of in a healthcare center or a hospital, they should be able to sort through the options with you.
And Elizabeth, states like New York have their own marketplace for health care. How will those states be affected? Or will the impact be any different in those states?
Yes. Unfortunately, between H.R. 1 and the unwinding of these enhanced premium tax credits, it disproportionately impacts do-gooder states like New York, who have expanded their Medicaid programs. We know medical debt and higher levels of morbidity and mortality have occurred in the states, mostly the southern southern states that have refused to expand Medicaid.
Where the MAGA base is.
Correct. It's really sad.
So they're going to be most affected.
They will be most impacted.
But also, but
New York will especially be impacted because, like, the good do-gooder states stepped up, expanded Medicaid. With the cuts to Medicaid, it will really impact those folks already. And basically, it dumbs down the rest of the country to the southern swath where they have disproportionate levels of medical debt, higher levels of morbidity, higher levels of mortality because they haven't expanded coverage. We know coverage counts.
And talk about the racial disparities when it comes to health care. I mean, the number of people who will lose their health care entirely, in the end, the public pays for that, right? Because they go to hospitals, they have to be taken care of, but many die. What does Bernie Sanders continually cite? Something like 65,000 people will die this year as a result of not having health insurance.
Right. What's really upsetting about losing coverage is what was amazing about the Affordable Care Act is it really undid many of the racial disparities we saw in healthcare coverage, and that was a really incredible thing. It truly was a force for improving equity in America. I'm sorry, your second question?
Racial disparities.
Yes, so it was overall. It really kind of undid that. If you gut the Affordable Care Act by not funding these tax credits and on top of H.R. 1, which is really trying to undermine Medicaid, access to Medicaid, that's like a double whammy that really will have profound impact against low-income people, people of color, and people who are sick. People with disabilities, people who have a healthcare condition like cancer or something that's completely out of their control. That's who was impacted the most by not having coverage.
And Elizabeth, will there be an impact also on the overall health insurance rates for the entire nation, not just for those who were using ACA?
Yes. I mean, the evidence is less clear about that. But if you pull out 20 million people out of various insurance pools, it puts more stress on the entire overall healthcare system. Costs will continue to rise. We've done nothing as a country to control healthcare costs. And so the only thing we can do is really try to grapple with how to get people back into coverage and stop this madness.
And finally, what about President Trump saying we want to stop giving money to the health insurance industry?
Well, that's just a lie. We were never giving money to the health insurance industry. The money was going to individuals. It's financial assistance that's run through the tax code with it to individuals. It basically provides financial assistance in the form of a tax credit to enable you to be able to buy coverage. If he cared about controlling health insurance profits, he would control health insurance companies, and he would require health insurance companies, providers, big pharma, to control their costs by rate setting, like countries like Switzerland. They have a private health insurance system, but the government sets the rates that providers, pharma is paid. We should do something like that at the very least.
And when you say at the very least, 10 seconds on universal health care.
Yes. I mean, obviously, the program that best controls costs in America is Medicare or the veteran system. And that's because we have government setting rates. If we care about costs and we want to expand coverage, we should do something about setting rates.
Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President of Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York, member of the New York mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's transition team. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Communication is everywhere, but what is it? Communication is how you share your thoughts, your opinions, your culture, from what you see on TV to what you post online. But what about the people who are not being seen or heard? AMI is a media company that strives to be a voice for Canadians with disabilities, whether it's through positive portrayal, reflection, and accessible media. AMI believes everyone should be included, and that includes you. AMI is inclusion. Experience AMI at amiplus.ca.